Hi, I'm Samantha, a past guest on CJAM's Handy Link. You're listening to Handy Link on CJAM 99.1 FM, reaching high ground in Windsor, Detroit.
Sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Jennifer Mizrahi from Respectability.
Tell me a little bit about Respectability.
So Respectability is a nonprofit organization that fights stigmas and advances opportunities for people with disabilities. It is led by a diverse group of people, the majority of whom are people with disabilities, and we focus on three things. It's fighting stigmas, it's the public policy around advancing opportunities, which is largely education and jobs. And it's the idea of authentic leadership, that people with disabilities should be at the forefront of all issues that impact people with disabilities. Nothing about us without us.
Oh. So what are some of the common stigmas you work to combat?
One of the most common stigmas that we work on is the idea that people with disabilities can't perform, that they are incapable. Now, by definition, a disability is a barrier to daily living. It's something that keeps you from doing one thing. So if you're blind, you can't see. But if you're blind, it doesn't mean that you're not the smartest person in the room. If you're a wheelchair user, you might not be able to walk, but you might also be the smartest person in the room, or the nicest person in the room, or the person with the most empathy in the room. So we're really trying to take away that pity frame, that handout frame, and to show people with disabilities for the amazing contributions that people with disabilities can make to a team through their intelligence, through their emotional capacity, through their loyalty, through their creativity, their resilience, their innovations, and more.
So how do you go about getting the word out about that, say, to those who still embrace such stigmas and myths? How do you go about breaking down those walls?
Such a good question. Well, the first thing is to understand where people get their information. How do they form their opinions about these issues? And what we find is that people today have a really close connection to what they're seeing on screen. They're watching videos, they're watching Netflix, they're watching Disney, they're watching television, they're constantly on their screen. So the best way to really change it is to change what they're seeing on their screen. So for example, on Netflix, there's a fabulous new series for children called The Healing Power of Dude. The Healing Power of Dude is a wonderful series about a young man with an anxiety issue, whose best friend is an Asian girl who's extremely talented, who happens to use a wheelchair. She herself has a mobility disability. And so you see authentic portrayal by an actress with a disability, of disability, on screen. And it's someone everybody would want to be friends with, somebody everyone would want to have in their life. So really working with the TV studios, with the other sort of content providers in the news media, to change what people are seeing around disability on their screens has been very important. The movie Crip Camp, which is a documentary also out by Netflix, is fabulous about the
you say authentic portrayals, do you ever find that it's presented as all inspirational or all bitterness or taken to extremes, basically?
Absolutely, Cam. This is a constant thing. I mean, people with disabilities are often shown either as incapable and subhuman, you know, like in the movies where they show someone who has a spinal cord injury and their quote-unquote happy ending is that they die by suicide because they don't want to be a burden on other people, or they're super crips. You know, in X-Men, they have these superpowers. So they're either subhuman or they're superhuman. We want them to be seen for the facts, which is human, you know, people who have skills and who have challenges, people who have love, people who have heart, and intelligence, and, you know, contributions in all kinds of different ways.
So, are there any challenges in this work?
Oh, there's so many challenges in this work. First of all, in Hollywood, people have thought historically that it would be difficult to hire someone with a disability, that it would be really complicated or really expensive, or that if they didn't do it right, they'd wind up getting sued. So working with the studios and the showrunners to help them see that, you know, look, you know, accommodations are not so complicated. Sometimes they're free and very, very simple. But it's all about asking people what they need. We call it ATP, ask the person. Ask the person, what do you need to be able to succeed in this space? So, you know, Sophie Kim, this actress from The Healing Power of Dude, she's an amazing actress. She can't go upstairs because she uses a wheelchair. So have a ramp there. It's not complicated. It's not rocket science. So that is one of the barriers. There are many barriers. Another barrier is that sometimes they think, well, if you introduce a character who has a disability, you have to create a whole backstory, and that's going to take a lot of time out of the show, and, you know, the shows are short. And you don't need to have a backstory. Why can't you just show somebody in the shot that if you have a character goes into a coffee shop and they order a coffee at the coffee shop and they show 10 people are at the coffee shop, why can't one of them just be a wheelchair user, or one of them happen to be blind or have Down syndrome? Why do you need a whole backstory? They exist in life and they should exist, exist in what we're seeing on screen.
One of the great examples of that is actually Law and Order. There's a character walks with crutches. They never said a word about it in the whole time.
Right, absolutely. I love that example. Because, you know, the fact is that people with disabilities are out in the world, and you don't need to hear the whole backstory of why that person is on crutches. They're a person. They're in the story, and they have other stories other than the disability part of their life.
So, in your time with Respectability, what's been the greatest success moment you've witnessed?
What a good question. It's interesting, Cam. We talked about our three areas of work. It's fighting stigmas, advancing opportunities, and the authentic talent pipeline. But I'll tell you a great story that is very recent, which is that because our team is led by people with disabilities and we're constantly in touch with people with disabilities, when COVID hit, we discovered through online conversations on Zoom and by doing large-scale polling that a huge problem was safe access to food because people had to go to the supermarket to get food. Now, in America, a huge number of people get food using something called food stamps or SNAP. It enables people who don't have a lot of money to buy food. Only guess what? You weren't allowed to buy it to use those food stamps for online purchase or for delivery. You could only use it if you went in person. So during the COVID crisis, we had to essentially lobby, although technically it wasn't lobbying, we were educating and advocating, with governors and with the federal government, because people were getting these food stamps that enabled them to go to the store and buy food. Why couldn't they just use them online and buy food online so that the food could be delivered to their homes, just like other people who were having food delivered? And this is really, really important for people with disabilities, because if you're blind and you go to the supermarket, frankly, you can't tell if somebody's right next to you and they haven't covered their mouth with a mask. If you're a wheelchair user and you're trying to go, you know, down the sidewalk and somebody walks towards you and they're not wearing a mask, you can't just jump off the sidewalk and sort of, you know, give yourself the 6 feet of space that you need. You're kind of stuck on the sidewalk. And so having safe access to food was never a part of our business plan. But now over 90% of people in America who use food stamps can now use them online. And that's 9.9 million people with disabilities in America that can now avoid having to go to the supermarket to buy their food. They can get their food delivered to them safely at home, which, you know, because COVID is really significantly out of control in America right now, is very important for the safety of people.
Right. Thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, I'll be chatting with Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley. He'll be telling us a little bit about how the Phase 2 reopening has impacted disability employment. So can you tell me a little bit about how the Phase 2 reopening might impact disabilities employment?
Well, actually, I had the opportunity to do a web seminar just a week or two ago across Ontario. And believe it or not, there's some opportunity that will come out of what's going on with COVID for people with different abilities. One case I can cite is this, that it has now been proven that working from home can be very effective for companies. Where before it was sort of a 50-50 split whether people believed that that would be a productive thing to do. But the evidence is quite strong that people can work from home. And for people with different abilities, it gives them the chance to not have to go through all that accommodation going into a physical building and to be able to do things they couldn't do in the past. So I think there's an opportunity there. There's also going to be some opportunities in areas that, like call centers and other places, and in with the shift from the corporate offices in Toronto and in major centers. That, again, gives people with different abilities the opportunity for jobs which they may not have gotten in the past simply because of prejudice against accommodation or things like that. So out of everything dark comes something light.
So when it comes to the myths of the impossibility of working from home, how are employers shifting from that because of the whole COVID situation?
Yeah, they're shifting. They're also going to have to continue that shift. Can you imagine in the high-rises, the commercial buildings in Toronto, that you've got the issue of the elevators, you've got the issue of the ventilation systems, you've got all those other issues. So I see a shift away from commercial real estate in many communities, including my own, to at-home work, which, again, should work in favor of those people with different abilities. So it's a challenge for everyone because we don't know how well the economy is going to reopen and how strong it's going to be. It may be not back to where it was, or it may even exceed that because of pent-up consumer desire. So, again, looking at this in a very positive manner.
So, in your work with persons with disabilities in terms of employment, as you've had a long-standing relationship with this particular topic, how would you say this compares to the willingness of employers to embrace such ideas in previous times?
We're not there yet. The jury's still out on some of the topics I just raised, but I think with time, it'll give us an opportunity to push an agenda that says there are many people out there who are well-educated, who have all sorts of skills, and they couldn't get through your front door to get hired, but they are available, and again, they're skilled and they're educated. So I think that'll be our message going forward. We're also seeing communities trying to attract home industries now, mainly because of the fact that people aren't going to be comfortable going back into mass buildings and large workforces. So it'll be the message going forward. The other thing, Cam, that I've done is in the last week or two, I've raised the issue of a guaranteed annual income, a basic income. I just did an interview on CBC Windsor this morning about this. And we've been, there was three pilot projects in Ontario that would have given people the opportunity to see if this works or not. Until the Ford government killed it, it looked like it was. Now, how do you exist on $1,200 a month of social assistance? And what guaranteed annual income will do is move people to a level where they can have a decent lifestyle and take care of their health issues and all those other things. And then most keep on working. And the best example right now is the CERB. 8 million Canadians are on a basic guaranteed income. And if you think about that, that was done very quickly. There's caps with it. You can control if there's issues of not adhering to the rules or not being eligible. So I think it's a great way to move forward so that everyone who's disabled in this country, who cannot work, is guaranteed a living wage so that they can have a life that is not one of despair.
So how are you going about pressing for the issue of a guaranteed income?
Well, I've written to the Prime Minister. I was encouraged to do that by a fairly significant Liberal member of the party in Ottawa, and I think they're looking to do a pilot project somewhere. We put our name forward back 3 or 4 years ago when the Wynne government was going to do 3 or 4 pilot projects. We weren't successful, but I think we're the right size, right balance of population to do it. So, I mean, I saw an opportunity in the COVID when so many people are getting their income guaranteed by the government, is that why can't we apply that on a smaller model to see if it properly works in the long term and if it's financially viable, which is key, because people forget that money doesn't go off to some Swiss bank account someplace. It's going back right into the community that people live in.
So there's been a lot of speculation about the whole, will there be tax consequences in the year ahead in regards to CERB? So I assume the model you propose for people with disabilities would not have this concern.
It should not. It should not. And my hope is it can be done in a way that we can get rid of the myths, prove this is a valid concept, or prove it's wrong. If it's wrong, I'll put my hand up and say, don't proceed. But I think the opportunity is there. And when you look at some of the disparities with CERB, you can get $2,000 a month, which is what most Canadians are getting. But if you're on social assistance in Ontario and you're disabled, you're getting $1,200, maybe a bit more a month. There's an inequity there that's not just. And as CERB disappears, we'll go back to the inequity. And I think this is the time to fix it. And this is a good time to fix it, because I now think most Canadians understand government has a role to play in bettering people's lives.
So what are the next steps forward in pressing to make this a possibility?
Well, the letter's gone to the Prime Minister. Obviously, the media are doing interviews on it. Continue to press it. I need Lambton County Council on July the 9th to endorse the concept again, and they did last time. So it's all incremental steps. I recognize the government's got many other things on its plate right now, just as local government does. So I'll just keep pressing it. And hopefully there will be a pilot project which would help people find out if this is workable or not.
So what message would you send to the community about your hopes for the end result of all this in terms of disabilities, employment, guaranteed income, stability?
Well, if they have the opportunity to talk to their MP, MPP, push it. It's all incremental, trying to move these issues forward. But, you know, all things change. And the social support network in Canada obviously wasn't functioning that well before COVID. It's had to ratchet itself up. So I think out of this, we have the chance to try to reform that system. And and it's great to see with technology, all millions went on CERB with little fuss. And yeah, there'll be some problems there. We know that. But many, many people went on there, and they didn't have to be bogged down in red tape. And one of the reasons I've had support on this issue is from conservatives, including conservative MPs, is that it reduces or eliminates the bureaucracy. All those different agencies, from Ontario Works to unemployment insurance, they disappear because it's a simple relationship based on your income with the person receiving the support.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thank you very much, Ken.
Of course. Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
Brain injury is the leading killer and disabler of people under the age of 44 and kills more people under the age of 20 than any other causes combined. Texting or talking on a cell phone while operating a motorized vehicle can lead to serious car crashes, brain injuries, or death. Take the pledge and help put a stop to distracted driving. Go to leavethephonealone.ca to make a pledge to drive only and never text. Everyone deserves to travel on our roads and communities without the fear of a distracted driver.
Welcome back to HandyLink, sponsored by the Italian-Canadian Handy Capable Association, an organization that provides recreational and athletic opportunities for individuals with disabilities in Windsor, Essex. For more information, check out ICHA on Facebook. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from Jennifer Mizrahi from Respectability and from Sarnia Mayor Mike Bradley.
In the next segment of our show, we'll get an update from our friend, Kate Jean Corbett Pollock. So, how has your work been affected recently by the whole pandemic situation, if at all?
Things have really changed for me. I started working at home. I've been working at home since March, early March. And I've been doing my classes online as well. And that was a shift. With working, it was kind of difficult at first to figure out how to loop Mike, my interpreter, into everything, because with some platforms, when someone is talking, the camera just switches to that person, and then Mike goes away, and I can't see Mike, and I couldn't always pin Mike to the screen, so we were using at work an app called Teams, and Teams was just not accessible to me, but we had to kind of figure that out the hard way, you know, and it was frustrating, and we just couldn't do the meeting on Teams. So we figured out that Zoom is much more accessible because I can pin Mike to the screen with Zoom, the whole conversation. So it was a bit of a learning curve. And it's also been hard for me because I have a learning disability called dyscalculia, and it affects things like I'm just not good with tech. And I had a whole system at my office of organization that I had gotten used to using. You know, I have a Mac at home, but I had a PC at the office, and it's just a totally different setup. So I kind of lost all of my organization stuff that I had on my computer, and it's just been difficult for me to kind of shift to a new mode of doing my work, and it's just been a challenge because I was so used to having the certain platforms and interfaces that I always used before, and that's hard.
So, how have you gone about coping with these glitches and this learning curve?
You know, it's caused me a lot of stress and anxiety. And I just, you know, have a good relationship with my supervisor. So, she sent me some videos to watch to try to learn how to do Zoom better. And I also just talked to my therapist about it. I've been talking to my therapist a lot. I'm having a lot of stress. You know, I'm having a lot of stress. And my stress level has been just higher than usual, honestly. And I also have a psychiatrist. And I was like, I think I need, you know, a med change because I've just been so stressed out. And not just because of work, but the whole pandemic is stressful.
So, have you found talking through these issues has proven effective? I mean, dealing with the isolation has its weight on everyone, but sense of community can sometimes help.
Yeah, I live alone, and it's just me and my two cats. So it's, you know, it gets lonely, and it's nice to have a Zoom meeting with people once we got that figured out so I could see my colleagues again. And, yeah, talking through it really helps, but I can't go in to see my therapist, so we had to figure that out, and I started using Google Voice on my computer because it's very loud, and I can keep my hearing aids in, and, you know, when I use the phone, I have to take the hearing aid out, and then it's like I'm even deafer, and I can't hear on the phone very well at all. So with Google Voice, it's coming through the computer, I have it on full volume, and I have my hearing aids in. And that's how I've been talking to my therapist. And thankfully, you know, I know her voice at this point. So I started with an interpreter when I started seeing her. But then it was just a one-on-one conversation, and I got used to her voice. And she's pretty loud, and she's easy for me to hear. So that was different, though.
So seeing a therapist with an interpreter, that must have it's been a different experience, in so much as most people think of therapy as sort of a one-to-one thing.
Yeah, it was different for her, too. She was really not used to having an interpreter in the room with a client at all. And she did not know what to do, you know, and I had to tell her, just act like the interpreter's not even there. You know, just talk to me and don't worry about the interpreter. because a lot of people are like, oh, there's someone else in the room. I need to talk to them and look at them. And do I include them in the conversation when I'm talking? Isn't it rude to just totally ignore them? But it's not rude. You know, you are supposed to ignore them and just talk to the deaf person. But that was kind of a learning curve for her. And then she was kind of worried because confidentiality, you know, and I had to explain that the interpreter is totally confidential. The interpreter is not going to talk to anybody about this stuff. You know, they're very good with that. And the ones that I choose to work with, I know, have really high ethics. But it was all a bunch to talk to her about. And since then, she actually had two other deaf clients now. And she took a sign language class to try to understand her deaf clients. So she's really cool. But at first, it was like just out of left field. I mean, she had no idea what to do.
That's kind of the thing. I mean, it comes from experience, no matter what the disability you're dealing with.
Hey, yeah, and, you know, she's had to, because I present a lot like a hearing person. I just have a little bit more hearing around the human voice than a lot of deaf people have. So when the interpreter went away and I was like, you know, Veronica, I'm fine with just one-on-one. I can hear you. I can read your lips. It's fine. It takes me about 6 months to get to know somebody's voice. And then it's like, oh, okay, well, I can hear you much better now. But at first, when I meet a new person, I really can't understand them. I have to get used to, everybody talks differently, you know, and everybody moves their lips differently. And that can be a real learning curve for me. But once the interpreter went away, then Veronica had to, like, remember, like, Kate is deaf, even though she doesn't really seem like it to me, because she's sitting in front of me, she's talking, and she's hearing me for the most part. And Veronica knows, like, speak clearly, speak loudly, and she does that, and look directly at me, and don't turn back, and all of these things. So she knows to do that, so it makes it easier for me. But sometimes she's got to remember, Kate's issues that she's talking about, they involve not being able to hear, and her stress levels are affected by not being able to hear out in the world.
So I was wondering, to change gears a little bit, have there been any new cases you've been following?
I haven't been following anything new. I decided to take a little bit of a break from that work because of the pandemic. It was just too much. I just felt like I needed to keep things kind of nice and light for a little while, but that's never really going to happen to me fully because I am a forensic science graduate student, and I am still learning about murder, and I am still learning about law and criminal law, and I have been taking classes this entire time. But I took a break from that, but one thing I did not take a break from was learning more about previous cases. So with the Erica Parsons case that I mentioned on the show, that's really my number one case that I feel most strongly about. One of the reasons, because Erica Parsons had hearing loss, and I really identify with that, of course. Another thing that I really wanted to learn about Erica was that she was born with fetal alcohol syndrome, and I did not know very much about fetal alcohol syndrome. So I took a class in the special ed department this summer called High Risk Infant, and it's about babies who are born with different disabilities. And I did a paper on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders so that I could better understand Erica. And that's something I've been wanting to do for a long time, is to understand just exactly, as much as I can, what she went through.
Like, thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Okay, thanks, Cam.
Of course.
This has been HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells, reminding you, we're all equal, so get on out there and have yourselves a good one. Something tells me you've earned it, folks. We'll see you next week.